CCD urges world leaders to adopt a crisis footing to solve land degradation. The authors warn that at no other point in modern history has humanity faced such an array of familiar and unfamiliar risks and hazards. It projects that if business as usual continues to 2050, an additional 16 million square kilometers, an area almost the size of South America, could be degraded. By contrast, if the world prioritizes land protection and restoration, it could lead to the creation of 4 million kilometers of new natural areas by 2050, with benefits for tackling climate change and biodiversity loss. Carbon Brief walked through 5 key takeaways from the UN's Milestone Land Report. The new report is by the United Nations Convention to Combat Desertification. The convention is the only legally binding framework that addresses desertification and the effects of drought and has 197 parties. It was established in 1994 via a direct decision at the 1992 Rio Earth Summit, which also gave the world the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change and Convention on Biological Diversity. The UNCCD is focused on rehabilitation, conservation, and sustainable management of land and water resources and is the custodian for Sustainable Development Goal Target 15.3, which aims to, by 2030, combat desertification, restore degraded land and soil, including land affected by desertification, drought, and floods, and strive to achieve a land degradation neutral world. 5 years in the making, the second edition of the Global Land Outlook GLO2 analysis, future land scenarios, and the contributions of land-based restoration to climate mitigation, biodiversity protection, health, and the UN Sustainable Development Goals. The first edition, published in 2017, mostly outlined the drivers of desertification. The report was developed in partnership with 21 different organizations and cites more than 1,000 publications. Partners include the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, and the Convention on Biological Diversity, CBD, as well as the Indonesia-based Center for International Forestry Research and Cape Town-based climate consultancy, C4 Eco Solutions. The report comes just 2 weeks before the UNCCD's 15th desertification COP, scheduled to take place in Abidjan, Ivory Coast, from May 9th to 20th this year. The UN hopes COP15 will serve as a key moment in the fight against desertification, land degradation, and drought, as parties step into what it describes as the UN Decade on Ecosystem Restoration from 2021 to 2030. This aims to prevent, halt, and reverse ecosystem degradation on every continent and in every ocean. Governments are expected to build on the report's findings and offer a concrete response to the interconnected challenges of land degradation, climate change, and biodiversity loss, the UN says. The report is split into 3 parts. The first part presents the many challenges to land systems, from biophysical drivers in the earth system to social and economic systems and their demands on land. The second part assesses land restoration activities and practices globally. The third part assesses the effectiveness and feasibility of global, national, and financial commitments to restoration. It sets out 3 scenarios through 2050: business as usual, a restoration scenario, and a restoration and protection scenario. The report was welcomed by UN Biodiversity Chief Elizabeth Maruma, who was interviewed in depth by Carbon Brief last summer, who called it a must-read for the biodiversity community. In a statement, she said, "The future of biodiversity is precarious. We have already degraded nearly 40% and altered 70% of the land. We cannot afford to have another lost decade for nature and need to act now for a future of life in harmony with nature. The GLO2 shows pathways, enablers, and knowledge that we should apply to effectively implement the post-2020 Global Biodiversity Framework. Carbon Brief presents 5 key takeaways from GLO2 and their significance for the world's climate and biodiversity. Humans have already altered more than 70% of the Earth's land area from its natural state, the report says. This has caused unparalleled environmental degradation and contributed significantly to global warming, according to the report. Because of human activity, an estimated $44 trillion, roughly half the world's annual economic output, is being put at risk by the depletion of natural resources, the report says. These resources underpin human and environmental health by regulating climate, water disease, pest, waste, and air pollution, while providing numerous other benefits such as recreation and cultural benefits, the report states. It cites analysis finding that at least 20% of the global land surface is now degraded, an area the size of the African continent. However, it adds that this estimate is conservative and notes that other assessments put the proportion of land degraded at between 20 and 40%. Degradation is particularly acute in dry land regions, which are today home to 1 in 3 people, the report adds.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly programme that will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organisations, communities and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how people in the subcontinent observe International Quds Day to reaffirm their solidarity with the oppressed people in Palestine. And we shall also take a look at how this day resonates with people in places like India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Kashmir in the context of their own struggles.
Four decades after the late founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini envisioned the day to reaffirm solidarity with the Palestinian people in their struggle for the liberation of occupied territories. Every year, on the last Friday of Ramadan, people across the world rally for the great cause. Some of the biggest international Quds Day rallies are witnessed in places such as India, Pakistan, Afghanistan and Kashmir, where it also resonates with the people's own social and political struggles.
International Quds Day has over the years become synonymous with a nation of solidarity with the oppressed people of Palestine in their struggle for the liberation of the third holiest sanctuary for Muslims. But as Imam Khomeini quite clearly stressed back in 1979, the day is not exclusive to Palestine and Jerusalem, but seeks to raise awareness about oppression everywhere in the world. The message resonates loudly with people in places like India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Kashmir. In Afghanistan, for example, International Quds Day has for years been used as a psychological mechanism to mobilize masses against the US-led foreign military occupation that lasted 20 years, as well as terrorist groups like Daesh and Al-Qaeda. In neighboring Pakistan, International Quds Day rallies see people chanting vociferous slogans against terrorist groups, including Daesh, Tehrik Taliban Pakistan, Lashkar-e-Jangvi, as well as new imperial powers hell-bent on destabilizing the country. In India, the day resonates with people's struggle against the alarming rise in Islamophobia and the growing proximity between the ominous forces of Hindutva and Zionism. In Indian-controlled Kashmir, International Quds Day has become an important annual event to speak truth to power, to rally for freedom from all forms and manifestations of oppression and subjugation.
The Himalayan region of Kashmir is one of the places where International Quds Day is observed with unadulterated zeal. The Muslim-majority territory sees massive processions on the occasion, both to express solidarity with the people of Palestine and to give voice to their own sufferings. Quds Day has become a permanent feature on the annual calendar of Kashmir, where Imam Khomeini is deeply revered and his messages are followed in letter and spirit. The day also holds extra significance as the stories of Kashmir and Palestine run parallel to each other.
Every year, International Quds Day rallies are held in different parts of Indian-controlled Kashmir with massive participation. People cutting across sectarian and ideological lines take part in these rallies. Kashmir and Palestine have many things in common: the imposed war, military occupation, settler colonialism, and people without voice and agency. For years, Kashmiris have spoken in one voice against Israeli atrocities in the occupied Palestinian territories. On many occasions, people have been arrested in pro-Palestine demonstrations. For example, in June 2021, at least 21 people were taken into police custody in Kashmir's summer capital, Srinagar, for chanting pro-Palestine slogans. Among them was a mural artist who painted "We Are Palestine" and showed a woman with her head wrapped in a Palestinian flag. Pro-Palestine murals, graffiti and slogans across the contested region show a shared sense of solidarity. Authorities fear these actions may lead to a wider socio-political movement against Indian rule in Kashmir. While India has rebuffed multiple UN resolutions calling for a plebiscite in Kashmir, Israel has brazenly dismissed numerous UN resolutions on Palestine's right to liberation from the Zionist occupation. But that has not prevented them from continuing their struggles and fighting on for their rights.
In Muslim-majority Pakistan, rallying for the cause of Palestine has become an article of faith for the people, while the position of successive governments also remains unchanged. On the International Quds Day, massive demonstrations are held in major cities such as Karachi, Lahore, Islamabad and Peshawar, which also sees the participation of major political and religious organizations. Furthermore, it becomes an occasion for people in Pakistan to raise their voice against foreign interference in their own country and the wider region, in line with Imam Khomeini's immortal message.
When the founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, called on the campaigners of truth and justice worldwide to commemorate the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan as the day of Al-Quds, people in Pakistan were among the first to stand up and take to the streets. Over the years, the tradition of expressing solidarity with the people of Palestine and other oppressed people on International Quds Day has been upheld with exemplary passion and conviction. The massive street rallies see the participation of people from all walks of life who march under one flag, the flag of resistance. These marches are generally organized by the National Solidarity Council of Pakistan, Majlis Wahdat-e-Muslimin Pakistan, and the Imamiya Students Organization. These organizations have openly come out in support of the Palestinian resistance movements, Hamas and Islamic Jihad, while denouncing Arab countries for normalizing relations with the Israeli regime. International Quds Day also brings people in Pakistan together to denounce America's destabilizing activities in the country, as well as sponsorship of terrorist groups active in the region. The country has seen a surge of violence recently amid the resurgence of terrorist groups like Daesh and Tehrik Taliban Pakistan, who many observers believe are backed by Western spy agencies.
If you are a true Muslim and a believer in the oneness of God and the message of the Prophet, then you help everybody who is oppressed or weak. And you give them a hand when you can. You give them some material support when you can. And if you can't, you do with your prayers and your da'wah. Wherever there is a Muslim brother who is being oppressed or maltreated, we've got to stand up and try to help. Otherwise, the word ummah means nothing. And that is what Western colonization and Zionism have been trying to do for the last 100 years or so, to divide the ummah on the doctrine, divide and rule.
In India, which is the world's second most populous country, home to more than 10% of world Muslims, solidarity with the people of Palestine is deeply ingrained in the country's socio-political fabric. The International Quds Day generates tremendous enthusiasm in big Indian cities, with large street rallies participated by both Muslims and Hindus. This is while the government in New Delhi has in recent years drawn closer to Israel with lucrative defense deals, marking a departure from India's traditional position on the Palestine issue.
On International Quds Day every year, slogans like "Down with Israel" and "Down with the US" reverberate across India as thousands of people pour into the streets in solidarity with the people of Palestine and in protest to the occupation of the holy city of Al-Quds. Among the biggest gatherings is the one held at Jantar Mantar, a popular protest site in the heart of New Delhi. Cities with a sizable Muslim population, including Mumbai, Chennai, Hyderabad and Lucknow, also see massive street rallies on the day, with the participation of people from both Muslim and Hindu communities. People in India have traditionally been staunch supporters of the Palestinian cause. However, the official Indian position on Israel's occupation of Palestine has seen a drastic change in recent years. In 1948, India was the only non-Muslim state to vote against the UN partition plan of Palestine. In the 1967 and 1973 wars, India denounced Israel as the aggressor. In the early 1990s, the policy began to change with the opening of the Indian embassy in Tel Aviv. Since 2014, when the Hindu nationalist BJP came to power, India has made its pro-Israel stance very clear, much to the chagrin of Indians who remain loyal to the Palestinian cause.
Well, all these people, they don't support anybody. They support their interests. I mean, Modi was dancing tango with Netanyahu in the open in the last few years. And now with the new advent of Ukraine, and people are sort of looking inwardly and saying, this is in the interest of my people, this isn't. And he is not supporting Palestine, he's supporting India. Like he said to America, no, I will not condemn Russia because they're offering me cheap oil. They were very, very open about it. Mercenary, yes, but this is politics, and this is modern politics, because unfortunately, since the Second World War, when America took the lead single-handedly ruling over the world, things have changed. No more principles, no more morals. It's gains and conquests and what you can get. And they've been doing it all over the world. Unfortunately, we in the Arab and Muslim world got our unfair share of American largesse at a point of a gun.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Wafiq Faour, an activist and member of Vermonters for Justice in Palestine. Now, welcome to the program, sir. As we know, almost 43 years after the founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini gave the call for International Quds Day, the biggest rallies today are held in the Indian subcontinent. So what is it that brings people to the streets in such large numbers on this special day?
Ayatollah Khomeini, and with the definitely acceptance of the rest of the world, mainly the Palestinian movement, that time when he announced it, they are very welcoming, because we as Palestinians, we understand Al-Quds, quote-unquote Jerusalem, is not a Palestinian cause or an Arab cause only. It's a Muslim cause and it's an international cause. And every year, as I am observing it, I notice that it's becoming bigger, because Al-Quds is a central issue to all Muslim around the world. I think Khomeini was... he read the future more than anybody else, believing that Al-Quds going to be central to the Palestinian question, and the question between the survival of Israel as a colonial entity on the Middle East or the demise of that entity. And I believe he was futuristic and very, very smart to do what he did.
Mr. Faour, as you mentioned before, Imam Khomeini affirmed that this day is not exclusive to Palestine and Jerusalem, but is dedicated to all the oppressed across the world. So how does International Quds Day today resonate with people in places like India, Pakistan, Kashmir, and also Afghanistan?
I'm not going to deny that there is oppression everywhere. I mean, you mentioned on India, the Muslim region of Kashmir and Afghanistan in particular. I mean, oppression is all over the world. Those two are central as well. I believe there is no difference between our struggle and the Kashmir struggle, because they want independence and self-determination as the Palestinians. On Afghanistan, I think it's a little bit different, because I don't believe the American occupation of Afghanistan is obsolete yet, and still they have a hand of what's going on over there, including the changing of the government of Pakistan just recently. I believe you have forces in the Western world who are creating the modern colonialism, that they're not going to let go of what's going on. They will never accept losing the battle and the occupation of Afghanistan. They still have power within the Pakistani army and the Pakistani system. And maybe it will take time, but things are changing quickly, mainly after what's going on Ukraine and Russia. And I believe everything going parallels, and the effect of that war, we we cannot predict it completely this early, on this early time.
Now, sir, in places like Pakistan and Afghanistan, international Quds Day rallies have also focused on foreign interference and activities of Western-backed terrorist groups. This is while many see the hand of Western and its spy agencies behind the recent terrorist incidents in Afghanistan. So what's your assessment on this, Mr. Fowle?
You see, on Afghanistan, it is still not a free yet from 20 years of war from the American occupation. And I think they left many elements and created many elements similar that what they are creating on Syria, on Libya, on many parts of the Muslim world, that they still on the payroll of the American CIA and American forces. And I believe those forces and those terrorist group, those extremists, they are creating what we don't want to see on the Middle East. And it started before 9/11, but 9/11 was clear, because until now we didn't read the full story of 9/11 and who created Osama bin Laden and those Wahhabi group, those extremists. But the world at one point will learn that much of extremism, it was a Western creation. American up front, but it had been supported by other Western forces as well.
Now, Mr. Fowle, what about India? People in India have traditionally been staunch supporters of the Palestinian cause, but the official Indian position has drastically altered in recent years. So why do you think that is?
The Indian government, as I read what's going on in Kashmir, they are extremists as well. The Hindu movement, they want to create a sectarian problem similar to what the West is creating in Afghanistan, on Syria, and in the Middle East. They want to divide the public based on their sect and their religious background. And they made the Sunnah Shia as a fight, and this is the struggle of what's going on the Middle East. The only beneficiary of this kind of division is the colonialist power that created and have been forced upon us from the West. This is the major problem, that some people bought to this idea that we are divided, even though our goals are the same. More things, 99%, I mean, Muslim, Sunnah or Shia, they believe on the same book, the same Muslim tradition. There isn't that division that the West have to like to highlight and to make it possible for them. The whole idea of creating this upheaval is to keep the West their foothold in our land.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Fowle for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Kashmir-based photojournalist Sayed Shahriar shares pictures taken at the International Quds Day rally in Kashmir's summer capital, Srinagar, in 2019, before the COVID-19 pandemic broke out. Dr. Hafizur Rahman, a New Delhi-based university professor and author, says he addressed the International Quds Day gathering at Jantar Mantar, a popular protest site in the heart of the Indian capital. Pakistani social media activist Sheikh Salim Ahmad notes that Pakistan has always supported the Palestinian cause, sharing pictures from International Quds Day rally held in Faisalabad city. Mirway Salamzoy, an Afghan journalist, asserts that oppression faced by Palestinians is akin to the oppression faced by all Muslims, adding that preparations are afoot for observing International Quds Day in Afghanistan. Kashmir-based university student Farooq Farhan shares a picture taken at the International Quds Day rally in Tehran to suggest that the day seeks to raise awareness about all oppressed people worldwide.
And that was our special episode about the International Quds Day, support for the Palestinian cause, and how it resonates with people's own struggles against injustice in the South Asian region. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Someone in the United States dies of this largely preventable disease about every 4 minutes, equivalent to a deadly disaster on the scale of the 9/11 attacks every 8 or 9 days. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Amy Goodman and Dennis Moynihan writers. This article is published under the heading "The Dire Consequences of the U.S. Neglecting the Ongoing Pandemic." Here's the story. Dr. Anthony Fauci, President Biden's chief medical advisor, told the PBS NewsHour this week, "We are certainly right now in this country out of the pandemic phase. Not all experts agree." With all due respect to Dr. Fauci, many experts think Americans are still very much in a pandemic in the United States of America. Dr. Jonathan Rayner of George Washington School of Medicine told CNN, adding, "Cases have risen in the United States over 60%. Currently, there are 15,000 people hospitalized in the United States with COVID-19, and that number has risen by almost 2,000 people over the last couple of weeks. And because hospitalizations are rising, Americans will soon see deaths rising." Dr. Fauci did announce he would not be attending the White House Correspondents' Association dinner recently. "I am 81 years old, and if I get infected, I have a much higher risk," he told CNN. "It is predicted that by Memorial Day, 1 million Americans will have died of COVID-19, almost certainly an undercount." Fauci also acknowledged, "If you look at the global situation, there is no doubt this pandemic is still ongoing." The Biden administration is at an impasse with Congress over emergency funds to confront the pandemic. Biden's $22.5 billion request for COVID funding was stripped out of the $1.5 trillion appropriation bill that passed in mid-March. A partial funding agreement is back on the table, but it eliminates the $5 billion Biden requested for global vaccination efforts. Dr. Ashish Jha, the new White House COVID response coordinator, said at a news briefing recently, "So far, Congress has not stepped up to provide the funds that are needed for our most urgent needs. Among those needs are the purchase of millions of doses of COVID-19 vaccines to provide initial shots and boosters in preparation for a potential surge this coming fall, and development of a new generation of vaccines that could potentially protect against multiple new variants. Expanding availability of antiviral pill is another major unfunded priority, as is the provision of some vaccines, antibody treatment that can be taken in advance by immunocompromised people to shield them from infection. Another White House funding priority is the distribution of vaccines globally. We've got to get the resources we need to get shots in arms so we can actually vaccinate the world and help bring this pandemic to a close, Jahaz said at a news briefing recently. At the moment, the U.S. government has no money allocated for this. To date, the United States has delivered 500 million vaccine doses to 114 countries. Dr. John Nkosazana, director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, credits the U.S. effort but says much more needs to be done. A recent study by the Kaiser Family Foundation highlights COVID's ongoing threat in the United States of America, especially for the unvaccinated. The report states approximately 234,000 deaths since June 2021 could have been prevented with primary series vaccination. These vaccine-preventable deaths represent a quarter of nearly 1 million COVID-19 deaths since the pandemic began. Kaiser also reports that in January 2022, COVID-19 was the single greatest cause of death in the U.S. for those aged 45 to 84, and the fourth greatest cause of death overall. Someone in the United States dies of this largely preventable disease about every 4 minutes, equivalent to a deadly disaster on the scale of the 9/11 attacks every 8 to 9 days. The WHO's target of vaccinating 70% of the population in poor and developing nations by the end of June 2022 is not going to be met, in part due to the U.S. government's elimination of funding for the effort. This could very well lead to the emergence of new, potentially more transmissible and deadlier coronavirus variants. In the globalized world, these threats need to be met with a global response. As drug manufacturers make record profits, ensuring vaccine access around the world is not only a moral imperative, but a practical, achievable goal that protects us all.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo Jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A recent report by the Council on American-Islamic Relations shows anti-Muslim hate crimes have been on the rise in the United States over the past year. In a news conference following the publication of the report, head of the council, Nihad Awad, described Islamophobia in the United States as deep and systematic.
Islamophobia has become mainstream in America. It made its way into the government institutions and public sphere through laws, policies, political rhetoric, and other manifestations.
Yeah, Islamophobia has been a huge phenomenon in the U.S. since 2001, when the September 11th false flag operation was deliberately used by enemies of Islam to trigger this tidal wave of hatred of Muslims and Islam that led to a series of wars that killed millions of people.
The report shows that the council received over 6,700 complaints nationwide last year, the highest the organization has recorded in 27 years, which represented a 9% increase since the year before. They involved a range of issues, including immigration, travel discrimination, law enforcement, government overreach, hate and bias, custody rights, school incidents, and free speech. Over 2,800 of the incidents were reportedly travel-related. The report cites last year's tensions in Afghanistan and the ensuing immigration crisis as the reason for such a large figure. The report also cites a 28% increase in complaints of hate and bias incidents, including the forcible removal of hijabs, harassment, vandalism, physical assault, and so on. The Council on the American-Islamic Relations describes what it calls the Islamophobia Network as a decentralized group of actors, organizations, and individuals that share extreme anti-Muslim ideologies who lobby to influence government policy and public opinion about Islam. They include politicians, think tanks, scholars, religious groups, and activists that paint a distorted face of Islam and Muslims for political and financial gain. Listed among the top financiers of the Islamophobia Network, according to the council, are right-wing evangelical groups and pro-Israel organizations, most of whom are members of the Republican Party.
Islamophobia has not only been profitable for Zionists and the military-industrial complex and politicians, but also for these con artists who've created an Islamophobia industry that sells all kinds of books and drums up contributions, often at churches, and gets funded by these billionaire, mostly Zionists.
Back in December, the U.S. House voted for legislation to counter Islamophobia globally. The lawmakers voted along party lines, with the Democrats edging only 7 votes over the 212 that the Republicans had cast. It followed U.S. Representative Lauren Boebert's Islamophobic comments against Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, one of the handful Muslim lawmakers in the U.S., earlier that month.
The Islamophobia industry comes up with all sorts of nonsense and sort of distorted, cherry-picked items from the religious tradition mixed in with all sorts of lies and kinds of grotesque accusations. And then spams this out in mass, and so it's really polluting the entire infosphere.
The United Nations has called for the adoption of a global strategy that includes defeating all forms of violent ideologies. The question is how to execute such a strategy to make it appealing to all nations and people.
The conflict in Ukraine has raised the prospects of an all-out confrontation between nuclear-armed states. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has warned about a real danger of World War III breaking out. In his comments to Russian media outlets, Lavrov added that given the current tensions between Russia and the West, the danger of a World War III was, quote, real. Lavrov also criticized Ukraine's approach to the talks and said if negotiations do not move in a reciprocal way, the negotiation process will be hampered. Lavrov also accused NATO of engaging in a war with Russia through a proxy.
And I think that the U.S. and their allies have been pushing the world towards a sort of World War III or even a new Cold War mentality for months and even years now, with the kind of propaganda and various official lines that the United States and their closest allies like Great Britain, France, and Germany have been pushing against Russia.
Meanwhile, Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba has criticized his Russian counterpart for warning of a real danger of World War III, saying Lavrov's comments indicated that, quote, Moscow senses defeat. Lavrov's warning came after the U.S. pledged more aid to Ukraine. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken paid a top-secret visit to Kyiv on Sunday and promised to supply more arms to Ukraine.
And I think that the NATO encroachments and the furthering of NATO interests throughout Europe as they get closer and closer to Russia's borders justifies some reaction from Russia. And the United States is going to continue pushing in their interest, which is only going to get us closer to World War III.
Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin hosted UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres in the Kremlin on Tuesday for talks revolving around the Ukrainian crisis. Putin said Moscow's move to recognize the breakaway republics of Donetsk and Luhansk was based on the Kosovo precedent set up by a UN-backed court. Following the meeting, the UN said Russian president agreed in principle to UN involvement in evacuations of civilians from Azovstal steel plant. Meanwhile, dozens of U.S. allies met in Germany to bolster Ukraine's military. Traditionally neutral countries of Sweden and Finland are also taking part in the meeting. The conference secured pledges from allies to sustain aid to Ukraine's military throughout this next phase of the war and beyond. The meeting saw a major pledge from Germany, which said it would deliver tanks to Ukraine in a radical switch in policy on the supply of military equipment to the country. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin added, the conference would transform into a monthly contact group on Ukraine's self-defense. According to a Pentagon official, at least 18 of the 19 towed artillery pieces Washington promised in the past 2 weeks have already been delivered to Ukrainian forces, and more are being rushed this week. In addition, Washington is supplying nearly 200,000 rounds of howitzer ammunition and is arranging for ammunition supplies for the Russian-made artillery that Ukrainian forces currently operate. France is sending its ultra-advanced Caesar mobile howitzer, and the Czech Republic is delivering its older self-propelled howitzers. Canada, too, is sending howitzers and advanced guided Excalibur shells that can travel more than 40 kilometers and deliver munitions precisely on target. The UK, on the other side, said it will send Stormer armored vehicles carrying anti-missile launchers to Kyiv. British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace said the country is also looking to provide Ukraine with long-range artillery and ammunition, as well as anti-ship missiles.
So I believe there is a limit to how far these countries will allow the United States to use them. And I think that when it comes to threats of nuclear war or the risk of a, you know, all-out World War III with Russia, I do think that we're going to see states in Europe start to stand up to that U.S. imperialism and try and go against them, maybe even allying with Russia themselves.
The European Commission insists that arming Ukraine is not about prolonging the conflict. However, a growing number of civil society organizations and lawmakers in the European countries believe the West should be prioritizing peace talks over arms delivery. Moscow has warned Western countries of the unpredictable consequences for arming Ukraine. Russia says it views Western military supplies to Ukraine as legitimate targets.
Israel is stepping up its atrocities against Palestinians. Israeli forces have shot and killed a young Palestinian man in Jenin. The man was identified as 21-year-old Ahmed Mohammed Lutfi Massad. He was a resident of the town of Burkin. He was killed during a raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the early hours of Wednesday. Officials say Massad had been shot in the head. Three other Palestinians with moderate wounds were transferred to the medical facility as well. The Israeli troops broke into dozens of homes and violently searched them, causing excessive property damage before detaining at least three Palestinians. Massad's death follows that of another Palestinian killed on Tuesday when Israeli forces stormed a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. 20-year-old Ahmed Ibrahim Owaidat was killed during the shooting in Akabat Jaber camp near Ariha. Nearly 50 Palestinians have been killed by Israelis since the start of 2022. Jenin has become the target of increasing Israeli military raids, arrests, and targeted assassinations in an attempt to crack down on growing Palestinian armed resistance there. The regime in Tel Aviv has escalated its crackdown on Palestinians since the beginning of the Muslim holy fasting month of Ramadan. It has also arrested dozens of Palestinians in the occupied East Al-Quds and desecrated Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Well, I think clearly Israel is trying to provoke the Palestinians. You know, this is just part of their long-term campaign of wanting to take more and more land from the Palestinians. To take over holy sites in Jerusalem that they want for themselves. And again, they're trying to provoke a response that would justify a greater military incursion, I think, into places like the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Damascus Gate.
The regime has further imposed new restrictions on the Palestinian people's entry into the mosque and ordered the demolition of Palestinian homes and agricultural facilities. There are fears of a possible large-scale Israeli invasion of Jenin camp. The armed wings of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Fatah movements are active there. Last week, settler incursions under police protection led to daily confrontations with Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Many Palestinians were injured and arrested. The Palestinian resistance movement of Hamas has also harshly warned Israel against further atrocities against Palestinian people. Hamas says Israeli threats would not discourage the Palestinian people from keeping up their legitimate struggle against the occupying regime.
Well, again, I think Israel's plan is to take over all of Palestine, to push the Palestinians farther and farther out of, in particular, the West Bank, but also Gaza. I mean, it's really a genocidal plan, right? I mean, the plan is either to starve out the Palestinians, force them to leave as refugees, as many have, so that Israel can take over the entire, piece of land there.
The heightened tensions come as people around the world are gearing up for Quds Day rallies around the world. The annual event is held on the last Friday of Ramadan. It was initiated by the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini, in 1979 to express solidarity with Palestinians and staunch opposition to Zionism. Palestinians have called on Muslim nations to play a more assertive role in securing the cessation of the Israeli regime's occupation.
The Israeli-Russian ties have been deteriorating rapidly over the past few weeks. Most recently, Russia's ambassador to Israel, Anatoly Viktorov, has warned that Moscow will introduce retaliatory measures against Israel in case the Tel Aviv regime supplies Ukraine with military equipment and aid amid the military conflict there. Viktorov issued the warning in a televised interview on Thursday. It was not immediately clear from the Russian envoy's remarks what such a response might entail.
And I think that we'll see strengthening of cooperation and increased military support for Syria and other regional partners of Russia in the region if Israel goes along with supporting Ukraine. And it's important to note that Ukraine has said that it wants to be in Israel. It wants to be Israel in Europe. It doesn't want to be absolutely liberal and European.
The comments came a day after the Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, said Israel will provide Ukraine with helmets and flak jackets. Last week, the Russian Foreign Ministry summoned Israeli ambassador to Moscow after Tel Aviv denounced Russia's military operation in Ukraine. It came after the Israeli Foreign Minister accused Russia of committing war crimes in Ukraine alleging that there was no justification for Russia's military campaign against its Western neighbor. Earlier this month, the Israeli regime voted in favor of a United Nations General Assembly resolution suspending the Russian Federation's membership in the UN Human Rights Council. The move was made over claims of gross and systematic violations and abuses of human rights in Ukraine. The Russian Foreign Ministry called the resolution, quote, unlawful and politically motivated. Taking a sideswipe at Israel and the United States, the Russian Foreign Ministry has said that the longest occupation in the post-war history is being carried out by Israel with the tacit approval of the West. The ministry further bashed the blockade of the besieged Gaza Strip, which Israel says is needed to prevent arms from reaching the Palestinian resistance movements in the enclave.
Well, one of the things that it's important is that Israel saying that Russia has committed war crimes is laughable, since Israel itself has been liable and the charges are severe to their war crimes and human rights violations against the Palestinian people, most recently in the war on the people of Gaza just last year in 2021.
Ukraine has asked Israel for weapons and equipment, including the Iron Dome missile system, something that Tel Aviv hasn't publicly approved so far. Russia has said that foreign weapons sent to Ukraine will be fair game for its military attacks. If Israel decides to sell arms to Russia's Western neighbor, will there be a conflict between the two?
So I think it's not yet sure what's happening, but I think what we are seeing is a shift of Israel from being neutral in this current special military operation to openly supporting Ukraine. So it might shift, but it will cost them. It'll cost them heavily because Russia is an important player in Israel-Palestine.
Since Russian President Vladimir Putin announced a special military operation in Ukraine on February 24 and officially recognized the breakaway regions of Luhansk and Donetsk as two republics, the political lines across the globe have been getting redrawn. As Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has warned, that risks the situation spiraling into a third world war.
اللهم أهل الكبرياء والعظمة وأهل الجود والجبروت وأهل العفو والرحمة وأهل التقوى والمغفرة أسألك بحق هذا اليوم الذي جعلته للمسلمين عيدا ولمحمد صلى الله عليه وآله زخرا وشرفا وكرامة
We here at IRIB English Radio congratulate the Islamic Ummah and all world Muslims on the blessed occasion of the Eid al-Fitr. A joyous Eid al-Fitr to you all.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Eid al-Fitr, the Eid of struggling to form a unified Muslim nation. May 25, 2020. The month of Ramadan, which is full of divine blessings for our nation and other Muslims, is over, and many happy people benefited from the blessings of this month. These people spent the day obeying God while they were fasting, and while they felt hungry and thirsty in such hot weather and on such hot days, and they avoided carnal desires and curbed the human passions. At night, many people engaged in prayer and dhikr, and they kept a vigil for God. Those who carried out their responsibility by worshipping God